Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to writer-director Joe Bannon about his upcoming short, The Wheel of Heaven, and the Kickstarter campaign he is currently running to fund it, more of which you can hear about at the end of the episode. And you can read about it in the show notes, and you can follow the link and donate to said campaign. Over the course of the interview, I chat to Joe about the early origins of the project, the short's influences, which he describes as being the Rocky Horror Picture Show meets Hour of the Wolf, and the other short film that is connected to this short film, which he is currently editing, The Blood of the Dinosaurs. Plus, I talked to him about why he is most attracted to surreal, abstract, and experimental film, whether he ever makes a film with an audience in mind, and we go off on a somewhat random tangent comparing notes on our favourite Nicholas Winding Refn films. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Joe. Hi Joe, welcome to New Horror Express.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you out there in New Orleans?
Doing all right, trying to survive. It's crazy as hell right now doing the Kickstarter and everything, but we're doing good. And I really appreciate you having me on the show. This is great.
That is no problem. No problem at all. So you mentioned the Kickstarter. The Kickstarter is for your new short, The Wheel of Heaven. So can you give a brief spoiler-free synopsis of The Wheel of Heaven?
Yeah, so The Wheel of Heaven is like a surrealist sci-fi, like weirdo mystery. And it's a short film. It's basically about this young woman named Purity who breaks down on the side of the road, and then she gets kind of caught up in this party that's off the road at a house. And it's just filled with all these strange characters. It's very like Rocky Horror Picture Show kind of, but also meets like very art house weirdness. So those kind of mixed together. So that's kind of a elevator pitch for the short film.
Okay, that's interesting. Like in the video for the Kickstarter, the promotional video, you describe it as Rocky Horror meets the Hour of the Wolf.
Yes.
Which I, you know, immediately had me on board. I was like, well, that sounds enticing.
Hell yes. I love Bergman. He's an amazing director. So, and it, you know, I love the old 60s and 70s art house films. And I feel like people shy away from the art house now because maybe like, oh, I saw that in school and it's old, or I just don't watch old films or some shit, you know? And there's so much like richness and depth to those, to the experimentation that was happening, especially in the 60s and 70s, that I feel like we've lost, you know, recently in film. And so I'm trying to bring that back, basically.
Yeah. And I feel like there might be other people out there who have similar sentiments. It feels like, because I've been, you know, in terms of people I've talked to on the podcast, and things I've kind of seen recently. So recently I had a guy on the podcast called Matthias Machete, who's a Brazilian guy. He directed a film called The Nuptials of Dracula, which is very much done in a kind of 70s kind of style. Is it very kind of art house, but also kind of meets kind of Gene Rollins type stuff. And also I saw recently as well, there was a film called Climate of the Hunter by a director called Mickey Rees. And again, it's done in a very kind of Daughter of Darkness kind of influence. Like, I feel like there's something there. There's some kind of art house, kind of 70s things on the fringes of things. Like a couple of things, of shoots of things coming out.
I think there's a resurgence happening right now, but it feels like it's just starting, you know, which is great. So it's exciting to feel like kind of on the ground floor in a way of like maybe a new wave of filmmaking, hopefully. But Mickey Rees, it's funny you said that because we've been some of the key cast and crew were like doing movie nights together for the next few weeks to get ready for shooting Wheel of Heaven. And we actually, our first movie night, we watched Climate of the Hunter. That was one of the films that we watched. And I'm a huge fan of Mickey Rees. I really just discovered him about 7 or 8 months ago. And yeah, that dude's amazing and very art housey, very weird, but also very accessible. He's got a good balance. So
yeah, I would agree on that as well. And I'm very much in the same boat. I didn't know who he was at all until basically I reviewed Climate of the Hunter for a website during Fantasia Fest last year. So that's like last August. So yeah, that's when I first became aware of him. And I know he's got like a new one coming out. I think it's called something like St. Agatha or something. So like, I'll probably check that out.
Two new movies coming out. One is like a horror nun movie, and the other one's like a Western or cowboy movie, something like that. Like, so yeah, he makes like two feature films a year for the last like 14 years. The guy's a fucking monster. It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I nearly had him on the podcast, but schedules didn't quite work out. But anyway, let's get back on to your film, The Wheel of Heaven. You said talked about movie nights. Obviously, I reviewed your movie last year, Sister Tempest, and there's a lot of different influences going on in there. So is there like a kind of required reading list for the cast when you're doing these projects?
Yes, they usually don't ever watch most of what I tell them to, but I usually give a giant list. I think Sister Tempest, we had like 12 movies that I was like telling everybody we need to watch, you know, just watch them. So in which it's hard to get people to like sit down, you know, and like kind of commit to watching a shitload of movies. So that's why I'm starting to do movie nights with my producers and key crew members and stuff, just to, so we can all get on the same board. But, you know, what I'm trying to do, especially with Sister Tempest and now going forward with Wheel of Heaven, I'm trying to kind of create kind of cinematic mixtapes. So where every scene kind of feels like it's taken from a different movie or a different time period or different genre. So that's why I like to take a big group of films and say, this is the movies that we're going to be influenced by. And try to watch them together. So I'd be like, oh yeah, remember that scene from this movie or that scene from this movie or the way they shot this movie. And we can use that as shorthand when we're filming. So I'm trying to create kind of like genre hopping mixtapes of all sorts of different films kind of jammed into one, but then create a narrative that you can follow throughout the film. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And actually, one of the questions that I was going to ask you was about that of, so, you know, when I was reviewing Sister Tempest, when I watched Sister Tempest, which I gave a good review to, I really liked the movie, and that's part of the reason I wanted to have you on, talk to you. But one of the things I kind of noted in that review was that, unlike some surrealism, some you know, it's fun for, you know, just to watch kind of wacky things go on. I like surreal psychedelic cinema. It's something that I'm into. But, you know, a lot of that stuff is quite, it's full of idea and it's full of metaphor and you watch it on a kind of intellectual level, or you just let it wash over you and it's just kind of fun. But often there's not generally an emotional core And I found with Sifter Tempest clearly a very deliberate emotional core to that movie. So like, yeah. is that something that you kind of focus on, of like creating those elements and throwing all those things in the stew, but having like an emotion to it as well? That you're like, oh, these are characters that I actually want to follow their journey. They're not just kind of moving chess pieces, which sometimes they are in surreal cinema.
Yeah, I really want to be telling a story that people at the end will feel some sort of emotional connection to. But I want to be able to, I want to tell it in an absurdist and off the wall and out of the box sort of way. So I'm trying to like, take that idea of the traditional narrative and then just kind of like the idea of a traditional narrative is like a jigsaw puzzle that's been made, but then I just want to like dump it out and rearrange it to where you know that there's still, it's still the picture, but it's slightly fragmented, but you still get basically an idea of what the story is at the end, but it's done in not the most traditional way. One movie that's similar that I try to take influence from is like a movie called How Su. I don't know if you've ever seen that film.
Oh yeah, the Japanese movie. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's such a great balance of like art house weirdness and like comedy and horror and just crazy psychedelics, but then there is a through line of a real narrative that when you get to the end, there's some sort of weird emotional weight to it. And so so I like that, because then you're it's almost like you can sit down with someone who maybe doesn't watch, you know, Dadaism or doesn't watch, you know, absurdist movies or surrealist movies. You can sit down with them and they can still be invested in the story, even though there's all this weird nonsense kind of happening at the same time. And that's what I want, you know, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was kind of going back to the Wheel of Heaven. We've talked a lot about influences. You said the Rocky Horror Picture Show, The Hour of the Wolf. Is there any other big influences on the Wheel of Heaven that you're aiming for?
Yeah, like so with Wheel of Heaven, there's like three or four like storylines that are all kind of laid on top of each other, and each storyline is like its own world with its own logic, but they all kind of follow the same narrative to the end. And so each storyline is kind of influenced by different films. Like one is very influenced by Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and one of the storylines very influenced by like old Twilight Zone. One is very influenced by like 60s and 70s sci-fi, like Star Crash and old Star Trek, knockoff Star Wars films, and that kind of like kitschy sci-fi. And one storyline is very influenced by like the Armenian films, like The Color of Pomegranates and those kind of art house films from that era. And so, yeah, so I'm trying to take all these like contrasting movie themes and elements and then lay them on top of each other. So like a lot of it is like taking the art house and the grindhouse and kind of marrying them together, essentially.
Yeah. It's pretty unique, and I like that. I kind of like that approach of like taking to like there's, I've only seen like a kind of few filmmakers like yourself who kind of so happily bash the quote unquote high art with low art and the you know, the exploitation and the in the art house. You know, it's not often you would, I've never seen The Color of Pomegranates. I hear it's a very good film. I know it's a very respected film, but you know, it's rare that you would see that reference with Star Crash, which I have seen.
Well, you know, I one person who does it for better or worse is like Quentin Tarantino basically does that same sort of thing, but it not to the extreme that maybe I'm taking it, but he's taking the grindhouse kind of, so many directors actually have done this in the past, like Martin Scorsese's done it, and taking that exploitation, like, because all these guys like Scorsese and George Lucas and that whole like 70s crop of directors that really came in their own in the 80s, they all grew up in the 60s art house and then moved into the grindhouse films, watching those films. And so they were influenced by art house and grindhouse. And then you had things like Star Wars come out of that, which kind of ruined movies. But it was that same sort of thing where he was watching, you know, Throne of Blood, but then mixing it with Buck Rogers in creating Star Wars. And I just don't think that's not happening as much as it used to. I think that was something that was happening more. But yeah. What I'm trying to go for is not necessarily marrying the two completely, but kind of putting all the different genres kind of right next to each other. So one scene will be strictly like 70s horror, and the next scene will be strictly 60s art house. And so you're kind of like a mixtape. So each song is, it's not like the songs are all mushed together. They're just all next to each other, you know?
Absolutely. I suppose what I meant by that was kind of pulling from that kind of more psychedelic, surreal kind of art house. Tarantino does that, you know, one minute he's pulling from French New Wave, you know, next minute he's pulling from the westerns of Sergio Corbucci, you know, he does do that, but it's a slightly more mainstream mixture of that, even though I am a Tarantino fan, and
completely, it's definitely more palatable, it's made to be more commercial. I'm kind of giving a big middle finger to commercialism and hopefully that I won't like ruin my career over it. But, you know, one person I think that's done that well recently is, a writer, producer by the name of Noah Hawley, I think is his name. He did, the Fargo TV series, but he also did the Legion TV series. I don't know if you've seen that.
I saw the first season of that.
It's pretty much, the first season's the best. It kind of drifts away after that, but it was a great mixture of like, you know, Marvel superheroes with like very weird art house psychedelic, you know, surrealism. So I mean, props to that, but that's kind of what I'm, you know, that definitely, I feel like that's somebody who, you know, I'm influenced by, inspired by as well.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering that, because like how much you kind of care in terms of like the divisiveness of your films, or you know, thinking about an audience when you're making the films, because like there's a bit in the kind of promotional for the Kickstarter where you're kind of talking about this conversation which you may or may not have had with a friend, and you're describing like, oh, it's Rocky Horror meets Hour of the Wolf, and then you know the friend is told you that, you know, you can't frame it that way, you know, nobody's heard of the Hour of the Wolf, you know, and you're like, well, yeah, well, if they've not heard it, fuck them, you know, like, is that how you really feel?
No, but I feel like it was funny.
It is funny. I laughed because I was like, I know what it is. I've got it on DVD.
Right. Also, you know, I think it's funny. And then at the same time, I feel like if anyone's going to be turned off because they can't Google a movie name, then fuck those. You know, they can't watch a trailer for a second and be like, oh, I understand what they're saying now. I mean, come on, you know. So I kind of half-heartedly feel that way. You know, and also I'm kind of tired of, there's this feeling that filmmakers kind of have to apologize for doing anything that is a little more esoteric or a little more, you know, absurd. I didn't mean to, like, I need to keep this this movie to be commercially viable. There's no commercial viability in like a $20,000, you know, micro budget film with no actors that anyone knows in it. So I'm like, fuck it. I'm going to do whatever I want because it doesn't matter. There's like such a one in a billion like possibility that, you know, whatever I make will be like the next like Napoleon Dynamite or something, you know. It's just like, it's not going to happen. So screw it. I'm going to make what I want. And that's, so that was what was amazing about like Napoleon Dynamite, you know, just throwing that name out of the blue. That movie, obviously those guys were not making that for any other reason, just for themselves. That was not a movie that was trying to be commercial. I mean, in any way. And I thought that was great. I remember watching like an interview with one of the producers and how they were trying to find casting, and people had maybe suggested bigger names in that film, and they deliberately cast like no name actors because they felt like that was really more true to the film, which is a bold move. Yeah. You know, when they had the choice, they had the chance to maybe put some bigger name actors in their film.
All right.
So,
and the only kind of sort of known name in the movie is like Dietrich Bader.
Yeah, is that the guy who is the kickboxing instructor?
Yeah.
And he's like in it for a second with like, it's so hard to even tell who he is, really.
That is true. And Dietrich Bader is one of those guys who's like, who turns up in a lot of things and you recognize his face, but you don't necessarily be like, oh, it's Dietrich Bader.
Right. Exactly. You know, and so, yeah. So I'm just trying to basically make what I want. I remember with God Inside My Ear, my first film, I was trying to create a film that was a little more like palatable to the audience, you know? And it was a good film. I'm very proud of what we did. But after making that film, I was like, you know what? It, like, I should just make exactly what I want to make, not worry at all. And so that's really what I tried to do. What I'm trying to do going forward with Sister Tempest going forward is just like, fuck everybody. I'm going to make what I want. But that's the thing. There's a lot of giant directors that's how they've made it, is they've made it by not compromising. And I'm just trying not to compromise, you know. So,
and I mean, like, yeah, if you've got the freedom to do it, why not? It's a bit like, I mean, like, you know, whether it works or not, I do respect that kind of move. It's like, yes. I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast a few times. I mean, I really respect, you know, Nicholas Winding Refn being like, yes, I'm going to take the kudos and credit and popular acclaim that I've got from Drive, and I'm going to make Only God Forgives. Right. And people are going to get angry.
Yes. Yes, totally. And I totally respect him for it. I'm not a fan of Only God Forgives. But I respect what he did with that film. Like, he just made the film that he wanted to make. And he's done that pretty much besides Drive. He seems to have just held to his vision, you know. Although Drive, I think, is a fucking masterpiece. But I think...
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, Bronson is his... That's my favorite out of everything he's done. Bronson is amazing.
Okay. I think... And actually, funnily enough, I am a fan of Only God Forgives. I think Drive's probably my favorite. Again, we're getting sidetracked, man. We're talking about your movies, not to rank the movies of Nicholas Winding Refn.
We can
do that another time if you want. But
yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's fine. It's my fault. I'm the host. I should be the one to keep things on track. So going back to the Wheel of Heaven, I wanted to ask you where the like initial inspiration for this particular short came from.
So I was writing another screenplay for a teleplay for a television series called Follicle. And that one is like about this young boy who has like hairy wolfman disease, and it's kind of follows his life and stuff. So during that, one of the episodes, I went off on a total tangent and basically wrote this story, Wheel of Heaven, and then realized, oh, this is like a self-contained film. So I just kind of took it out and said, let's make this, you know, because I'm not going to find funding for a giant miniseries, television series for Follicle anytime soon, but I could find funding for this short film. So that's what I did, basically.
And in the IMDb credits, you're co-credited as writer with Jason Krupa. And as far as I can see from your other credits, this is the first time you've co-wrote something. How different was that writing process to your normal writing process?
So with Jason actually has, although it's not on IMDb because I need to update it, but in the credits of the film, he has co-writing credits for Sister Tempest as well. But basically, Jason has been more than anything a creative partner and like a sounding board for me. So what I'll do is I'll usually write the first draft and maybe second draft, and then I'll hand it off to Jason, and he'll, you know, kind of give me notes and then maybe rewrite some things. With Sister Tempest, he basically wrote a bunch of the backstory that's in the film. So he kind of is a good common sense for me, because I will write absurdist nonsense so much that it's just nonsense completely. And he'll ground me and be like, let's get more of emotional core. Let's get things more, let's center it around the humanity of the story a little more. So that's what he's done for Sister Tempest and for Wheel of Heaven. So basically that's it. But yeah, he's a great creative partner. He's also a wonderful photographer, and he does a lot of the music for my films as well. So just a good collaborator, you know.
And
a writer in his own right. He just published a book about George Harrison. I think that's coming out soon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, pretty cool stuff.
Well, that's nice. So the other short, Blood of the Dinosaurs, it says is a prologue to the Wheel of Heaven. Did you write them both at the same time?
Yes, so I wrote Wheel of Heaven in four chapters, and basically Blood of the Dinosaurs is the first chapter. And then I just created it and made it into a singular film, because it could be cut out and made into its own entity. And so I just made it, instead of chapter one, I made it into the prologue, because it's basically what it is. But you can watch both these films separately and not lose anything, or you can watch them together and they'll like create even more depth to each other. So that's kind of the way it came out. So Blood of the Dinosaurs is like an introduction to Wheel of Heaven in a way, even though it stands on its own. And it's about this children's show host named Uncle Babbo, who teaches us where oil comes from, which is, you know, the blood of the dinosaurs. And Blood of the Dinosaurs kind of starts at the beginning of time and then goes into this children's story and then kind of wraps into itself. And once you watch it, it'll make sense. It's basically like Circle of Life, kind of. It's an essay on the Circle of Life, essentially, is what Blood of the Dinosaurs is. And then it ties into Wheel of Heaven. And then we go into Wheel of Heaven. So yeah, that's what it is. I know none of this makes sense, but once you actually watch it, it'll make more sense. That's why it was hard to create an elevator pitch and create a pitch on Kickstarter. So I just made it a little more nonsensical, because it's strange cinema that's more on the poetic side than a straight narrative side, you know? And especially with Blood of the Dinosaurs, it was my first kind of non-narrative film. It's much more of like an essay and a weird poem than it is like a narrative. And then Wheel of Heaven is much more of a narrative.
All right. After watching the trailer for Blood of the Dinosaurs, I was going to ask you about the casting of this Uncle Bobo character, who's played by an actor called Vincent Stalba, who it intrigues me. It makes me want to watch it. But he has a very particular look that looks at the same time, both very innocent and incredibly sinister.
Yeah, he's amazing. Amazing. So I probably auditioned like 5 to 10 actors, somewhere around there. And Vincent had seen my first film on Amazon Prime. Vince, he lives in LA. I live in New Orleans. And he just saw my first film out of the blue on Amazon Prime and sent me an email, said, I really loved your, I loved God Inside My Ear, and I'd love to work with you, and sent me some of his reels and stuff. And we started talking and became friends on Facebook, social media. And he's like one of the sweetest people I've ever met in my life. Like a truly kind-hearted, warm, like just beautiful person. And so he auditioned for this, for Uncle Bobbo, and it was just fucking nailed it. Nailed it. And so, yeah, he flew down from LA, slept on my couch. We hung out for like 2 days and shot the scenes. And he is unbelievable. The guy, first of all, once you see the short film, he doesn't blink through the entire thing. And there's long one take shots of him just staring into the camera and doesn't blink. He's like on the entire time. Every take is exactly the same. The guy is a machine. It's just wild. He's like wonderful to work with. Just, I can't say enough about him. I can't believe he got into the character so much that it's a much scarier film than we anticipated it to be. I kind of was going for more of kind of a like the Uncle Bobbo character was initially going to be like this clumsy kind of Tim and Eric quality kind of character. And when he auditioned, he brought such this predatory, you know, nature to it that it was just perfect. It was like, exactly, this is Uncle Bobbo. This is him. Freaky child predator. Yeah. So that's the host of a children's program.
It's just like, yes, like I said, you know, like it made me intrigued to watch the short, because, you know, as we're kind of, you know, the talking about influences and, you know, things being this crossed with that, it's like, I don't know, it's like Patrick Bateman meets Mr. Rogers, something.
Yes.
Along that line.
Completely. Yes, and he's got a real Norman Bates look to him. I mean,
that is true. He does have a real Norman Bates
look. Yeah. And, you know, the only direction I really gave him was I wanted to where there's a tumor basically in your brain to where, you know, you have a delay on everything that you're thinking and saying. So you like, you've got a real slow timing to yourself. And that was basically the only direction I gave him. He ran with it and he was just perfect.
And I was looking at the rest of the cast from both The Wheel of Heaven and on The Blood of the Dinosaurs. Yeah. And I noted that a lot of the actors were people that you've worked with before on Sister Tempest, other movies, yeah. The likes of Callie Russell, Miles Hendler, Tiffany Christie, Holly Boney. Did you like working with the kind of the same people?
Absolutely. Yeah, I want to just keep doing that. Like, I like having a troupe of people. It makes it much easier to write. You know, when you're in, like, I wrote that the character for Wheel of Heaven, the main character, Margaret or Purity. I wrote that for Callie because it was like I knew what she could do. So it was just very easy to write for that person. And I like that troupe mentality. I feel like it feels like sometimes directors are scared to use the same people over and over, but you're able to really carve your own style. You know, if you use the same people, not everybody exactly the same over and over, you got to introduce new people to every film just to kind of add more ingredients to the recipe. But if you know somebody works and you've worked with them before, then there's no reason to reinvent the wheel, you know?
Yeah. And so, yeah. So you're kind of happy working with the kind of the same troupe of actors and having that kind of troupe mentality. And I was also going to ask in terms of location as well. So you're in New Orleans, you know, what's the kind of film scene out like there? You know, is that where you want to be based? You don't have any desire to move to like New York, LA, you know, one of those other, bigger places for film?
No, I don't have any desire to move. I mean, I'm born and raised here. You know, my family's here. I'm not nomadic at all. I moved one time in my life to the house that I married my wife, and we moved to from my childhood home to my house that I live in now. Mm-hmm. And I've lived there for 22 years. I'm not a move around at all sort of person. I like to travel, but I like having my family around me, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So I have no, I'm also like, I don't like the Hollywood scene at all. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to like live in Hollywood to be able to make movies anymore. It's not the 90s anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. there's a great film community in New Orleans. There was a lot of movies being shot in New Orleans about 10 years ago or 5 to 10 years ago. There's still a lot still, but about 10 years ago, it was like every Hollywood film was being shot in New Orleans or Louisiana. Mm-hmm. For a time, because Louisiana had gotten rid of all the tax, gave a bunch of tax incentives and stuff. And then about, I guess, like 8 or 9 years ago, they got rid of the tax credits and Hollywood packed up and left and went to Atlanta, where they had a bunch of tax credits. And so they're still shooting over there. But what happened was there was a lot of filmmakers that moved here or that kind of started in the business because of what was happening at the time, and they didn't want to move. And so now there's like a good indie film community, like a fairly thriving indie film community. And there's still enough films being shot to where, you know, they still can be employed and then also make the indie films. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, it's a great, wonderful community that really cropped up because of Hollywood coming down and kind of shitting on us.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, I love it. I don't, there's no reason to move, yeah. You know, except to like go maybe have meetings, you know, in LA, but I don't need to live there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. It's been one of the interesting things of having this podcast is kind of finding out where these little pockets of like film communities, both in the States and Canada and other places that you maybe don't naturally associate. I talked to another pair of filmmakers from New Orleans about their Katie Amond and Sarah Zanotti, who made a film called Faye, which they shot entirely on iPhone. It's a one-woman horror movie. It's pretty right. Cool. Yeah, and I've talked to a bunch of people from Austin as well, and the thriving film community there. So, like, you know, it's different places. And we were talking about Mickey Reese earlier, and he's doing his own thing in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the thing now with social media and with the technology the way it is, there are filmmakers everywhere. Like, I could go in the middle of Podunk, you know, Mississippi or like just anywhere, like just throw a dart at the map, you know, and there's going to be people that have the equipment and, you know, are desperately wanting to make movies, and they might be shooting weddings or something, but they are out there wanting to make movies. And what's even better is when you go into smaller communities is everybody's even more excited. So it's extremely cheap to make a film when you go out into some, you know, no name town, because everybody wants to be part of the films. Everybody's going to give you locations for free. Everybody's going to work for free. Not that you want that, but you're going to be able to, you know, make films on the cheap, and, you know, no one's going to make money off of it, including yourself, but you're able to make the films at least, you know. I've talked to filmmakers in LA all the time, and they're not making anything because it's too expensive. It's just, there's no, I was talking to a LA filmmaker yesterday, and he said, even to film in his house, he has to pay for a, like, you know, some sort of, you know, event fee or some shit, like $1,000 a day just to now they, he doesn't do it. He's like, I'm just going to film no matter what. Screw him.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
And he says, like, you'll film on the street and the neighbors will start turning their music up or mowing their lawn just so they will, you will have to pay them to like stop the noise. Like everyone is looking for a payment in LA in the, in that area because everyone's filming. So, so yeah. So no one's making, like, it's really hard for indie films to make films in LA. So yeah, I mean, it's like, you can go anywhere and make films at this point.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, so you've filmed Blood of the Dinosaurs. So right. it's complete, and you said you were editing that now. Yep. Obviously, I know you've probably had like a small cast for it, but presumably it was filmed in 2020 under kind of COVID social distancing conditions. How difficult was that?
Well, I wrote it to where there was very little actors and very little contact. There's like one scene in like a labor delivery scene where people were a little closer and there was a little bit of a bigger cast, and it was one day, and we really pushed it to like the towards the end of everything. So it's, you know, we just tried to be as safe as we could. But everything else was done with like one to two actors, not next to each other at all. You know, we just tried to keep it as safe as we could, you know? So that was another thing too, with Blood of the Dinosaurs. It was a perfect little chunk that we could take out that we could feel like we could safely film and then wait until restrictions had lifted to shoot Wheel of Heaven, basically.
And have you started filming Wheel of Heaven? Is that
no, just waiting for the Kickstarter to end, and then we'll probably the plan is to start filming in August and September, and it'll probably be about 5 or 6 days of shooting, since it's a short film, you know, fairly quick. So,
and how long did it take you to film Blood of the Dinosaurs?
It's about, well, it was 4 days total, but it was really 2 days of shooting. And then the other 2 days were like things where it was just me and the DP, like shooting miniatures and stuff like that. So, but 2 days of real shooting, you know, talking, acting footage, essentially. So it was 8 pages for Blood of the Dinosaurs. So not very much, not very many pages. We have learned to shoot fairly quickly. With God Inside My Ear, it was 97 pages, and we shot that in 13 days. And with Sister Tempest, it was 135 pages, and we shot that in 22 days. So we're very accustomed to having to shoot very quickly if we have to.
Wow. 135 pages in 22 days. That's impressive.
I mean, really, it's all because of my DP, who just can, Daniel Waghorn, can set up a shot in like 5 minutes and shoot it, and it looks beautiful, you know. So if you can get a crew that can move quickly, then you can really do anything. You can shoot a lot in a day.
So was the shoot of the Blood of the Dinosaurs pretty smooth then?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was funny that the hospital scene was a little funny because I think that they were a little nervous. It was like a medical center, and they were definitely nervous. We were moving around very expensive equipment and like having to set up the scenes and moving furniture all over the place. But nothing broke. We put everything back. Everything was looked great, but it was a little like, oh, are they gonna kick us out? Like, but we did okay.
We talked a little bit about like in terms of thinking of an audience and just focusing on your vision and not getting too hung up on like will this be commercial, is this commercially viable and stuff like that,
right?
So you know, we also mentioned You know, I reviewed Sister Tempest. I saw other reviews of Sister Tempest that were good. And it seemed to come out to really good reviews. How much do you pay attention to that stuff as well? Like,
oh, you know, I'm better than I was. I remember, right, okay, God inside my ear. I was like so proud of it when we made it, and I thought for sure people are going to love this, and the film festivals are going to love this, and you know, if you go on IMDb, God inside my ear is like 4 point something. People didn't love it like I thought, you know, and there was so many. I mean, if you look at the reviews on just normal reviews, not as much as like reviewers, like official reviewers are almost always nice 95% of the time. Even if they don't like a film, they're not going to tear it down, you know. Although I've had a couple of those, but if you look on like IMDb or Letterboxd on Sister Tempest and God inside my ear, you'll find some reviews that are just incredible, like just like, this guy should kill himself, you know, like, or this is the fucking worst piece of shit I've ever, just like wild reviews that you're just like, these, I can't believe people write, like, I can't believe people, I don't care if they, you don't know what your real name is. That's, did your mother raise you to be that mean? Like, it's just very strange, you know, it's weird how the internet makes people feel like they can be just assholes, you know? So, yeah, with God inside my ear, I really was took some of that shit personally, and now I don't care. Now I just think it's hilarious. And but I do really do listen to the very bad reviews and the very good reviews. Like, I want to hear people I want to hear people really respond to the film, either negatively or positively. But I like a real, visceral, true response. The ones that really depress me are the ones that are like, eh, it's okay. I don't know. Like, just like they didn't get any, they don't feel anything. Like, it's very strange to me. I'm like, I need you to feel something. Like, even if you hate it, just say you hate it, you know? But so yeah, I was definitely like hard, you know, from the first film, but now I think it's great. If somebody like really hates my film, like it's I don't know, there's something that's satisfying about it. if I can get them to at least respond that drastically, you know, I think it's great.
Yeah, although I mean, you know, some people are nuts. I mean, like, to put in any review this guy should go kill himself, like, you know, I mean, I really hate some Michael Bay films, but I don't think that Michael Bay should kill himself. I have no like personal vendetta against Michael Bay. I just think some of his films are shitty.
Right. Yes, totally. Well, you know, the ones that the only real negative reviews that will still get at me are the ones that are like official reviewers, you know, that are writing for official websites. And that hasn't happened very much at all. Like, just like 2 or 3 times tops, you know. Most of the time, if an official reviewer doesn't like a film, they'll just be very cordial about it, you know. But those will get under my skin, just because I'm like if they're being scathing or being like rude, you're just like, what? Did somebody actually, an editor actually read this and be like, oh, that's cool, you call this dude a dipshit in your review. Yeah, that's fine. Like, what? Like, your mother didn't raise you right. It's just weird. I just don't get it.
Yeah, I think to use a kind of sports metaphor, you know, in terms of my reviews, in terms of what I do, I'm, you know, I always live by the motto of, you know, like, always attack the ball, not the player, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this, because, totally. You know, it's not fair. It's not right to do that. You know, you might not like something, you might not like a film a person has produced or any piece of art that a person has produced, but to go after them, to say like, oh, this guy is an idiot or, you know, whatever, you know, it seems, yeah, it's unsavory.
Yeah, but I do enjoy a good bad review, like somebody who points out what they don't like or what they hate, and they point it out and they like, you know, like pointed out in a very intellectual or, you know, non-emotional, just like, look, this is why I don't like these things. I think it's great because I liked it. If I hear the same thing over and over, that's bad, you know, about what I'm doing, then I will take it to heart and I'll listen to it. I'll go, well, maybe I need to change that, you know? And then sometimes I'm like, no, fuck them. I'm not going to change it because they just didn't get it, you know, or whatever. But I will listen. You know, I feel like that's the only way you grow as an artist is to have some thick skin and listen to both critiques and to, you know, like positive reviews. I think it's good because if you hear the same positive thing over and over, then you can go, oh, I'm going to keep doing that. And the same negative thing over and over, then maybe I'll stop doing that, you know? So I think it's good. I love reading. I read every review, no matter who it's by, no matter how stupid it is. So
fair enough. I think that's very admirable in terms of thick skinness. Yeah.
Oh, I think it's incredibly important to grow as an artist, you know, is to have super thick skin. And I just don't understand guys don't. One of my favorite reviews from Sister Tempest is one I'll read real quick from Letterboxd, just one sentence. This guy says, I don't know if I was particularly horny watching this film, but I had a consistent chubby. And that is just, that's got to be put on on a poster somewhere. Amazing. That's the reviews I live for.
Well, that is certainly a confession, you know, like.
I love it.
So. Oh, dear. That is a level of honesty that most people just won't have.
Yes, it's true.
After that, that's kind of thrown me off the game. yes, as we kind of wind down a little bit, let's talk about the Kickstarter campaign. We've kind of mentioned the Kickstarter campaign, but this is your opportunity to really promote the Kickstarter campaign and tell everybody where they should go and what they should do.
Yeah, if you go to wheelofheaven.com, that will redirect you to the Kickstarter. Or if you go to Kickstarter and, you know, search for Wheel of Heaven, it'll pop up that way. Or if you go to Facebook or Instagram, go to Facebook and you can search for Wheel of Heaven. If you go to Facebook or Instagram and look up my name, Joe Badon, you can search for me there and find me there. But yeah, wheelofheaven.com, go over there, check out the Kickstarter. You can check out we have the Kickstarter video, which is, I think, fairly funny. And we also have the trailer for Blood of the Dinosaurs on there. If you donate, I think, $20 or more, you can get both films. You'll get the Blood of the Dinosaurs and you'll get Wheel of Heaven. And yeah, if you like weird movies, if you like art house cinema, if you want to just watch something different or something strange, this is what I'm doing. These are the kind of films I'm making. This is my heart to make weird cinema, to get that back into the zeitgeist of film. So
excellent. And apart from the Wheel of Heaven, have you got any other plans of, like, you know, possible features in the future or anything like that? Or are you just entirely focused on the Wheel of Heaven Kickstarter campaign and then going into filming on that?
Well, I mean, I have other things in the works, you know, but of course they're all in planning stages right now, because, you know, you got to finish one project, go to the next project. But we are looking for funding for a feature film right now that it's top secret. I tell you the name, it'll look kind of like, I feel like it's too much. So it's like a total top secret thing. It is there. I will say this. There's a lot of kung fu in the film, which I'm very excited about. It'll be like the first kind of action-based film that I've done. I'm excited. We're about to start seeking funding for that. So that's just in the pre-production phases. So,
okay, that sounds cool. So you said that you're currently editing the Blood of the Dinosaurs. When will we see those come out? Was that going to come out the same time as the Wheel of Heaven? Like, what's the kind of schedule that you have for that?
So the Blood of the Dinosaurs will be like, once we're finished and once the Kickstarter's done, everyone that backs the film will get, you know, backs $20 or more, will get Blood of the Dinosaurs first. And then we'll, once we're finished editing Wheel of Heaven, they'll get Wheel of Heaven as well. So it will be kind of staggered. Blood of the Dinosaurs will come out first, but it will come out exclusively to the backers first. And then we're going to submit it to film festivals. And then probably about, you know, 6 months later, it'll be out in film festivals. And then Wheel of Heaven will come out and be given to the backers first and then submitted to film festivals and kind of done, staggered in that way. So yeah, so it'll, you know, if you want to see it before everyone else does, the Kickstarter is the way to go.
Okay, so we recommend our listeners go do that. Go over to Kickstarter and give some money to the Wheel of Heaven. And we will obviously, in this episode, below the line, we will give the link so it's super easy for you all to do that if you want to do that. And also recommend that you check out Sister Tempest, the review of which you can see on the site. Yes. I suppose that is just leaves me to say thank you very much again, Joe, for coming on the podcast. And please do come back anytime soon.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That was my guest, Joe, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. As always, I would also like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. If you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the pod on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Plus, if you're giving us a review, please be sure to make that review 5 stars, as otherwise it angers the almighty podcast algorithm gods. And you wouldn't want that on your conscience, would you? No, I didn't think so. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to join me again next Monday when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.